My name is Chuck Larson. My name is also Ch'anta Wahajux. And I am of the Hanoa family, of the Chunanatawan Seneca Nation, of the Haudenosaunee Iroquois Six Nations. And I am something of a scholar. My primary source for this tape is the work of Dr. Willard Bill, who is Director or Coordinator for Indian Education in the State of Washington through the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction. He is an old friend of mine in Duwamish, and these two anecdotes which he told me about Chief Sealth are family or tribal oral tradition. Chief Seattle, whose real name was Sielch, which is most closely approximated in spelling as S-E-A-L-T-H, but the T-H is not pronounced behind the teeth, but rather out of the sides of the mouth, Sielch, was a CM. A CM is a chief of sorts, a headman. The title CM, S-I-E-M, does not really mean chief by our standards. A CM was someone who was recognized by other people in the community for unique talents or abilities and was put into leadership roles by them. A person could be a son or daughter of CM and never become recognized by the community as CM themselves. On the other hand, the kinds of abilities and talents, the attitudes of life that were common among the leaders of the communities in the old days very often were handed down to their children. And so CMs often would pass down in a line, father to son or grandparent to grandchild. Still, the community decided. No one calls themselves CM. It's when the others come to you and address you that way that you become CM. CM means that you are talented enough to bring together the efforts of other people and the resources within your environment so that you can give away to your people, to your tribe, and benefit everyone. The CM might be the political leaders that know best how to capitalize on the skills and talents of each individual in the community or within their family so that they can produce the greatest amount of wealth, which can be then given away to the community and shared among all. CM often refer to themselves as poor men or poor women because everything they amass has to be given away. A person who hoards or who acquires possessions in excess of his needs just to have them is not respected and is not CM. The man whose generosity matches his ability to organize and coordinate the efforts of others to produce wealth and to share it through the community, that person is CM. This was the real meaning of chieftainship among the people of Puget Sound, the Salish people. The term CM is used both by the Lushootseed, that's L-U-S-H-O-O-T-S-I-D, Salish, which are all the people from the Skagit River south around the southern end of Puget Sound to the Cowlitz, and also by the Heilichemen, and I don't know how to spell that word, but these are the people who live north of the Skagit into the Straits on the islands of the San Juans and up into the Fraser River and the Nooksack, and it is also, I believe, the dialect of the Klallams over on over on the top of the Olympic Peninsula. So the word is used at least in two dialects that I know of, and other words with exactly the same meaning are used by other Salish groups. Sialf became a CM as a young man as part of a very bizarre chain of circumstances. One of the things that is very important in Indian life is that they pay their debts. The core of Salish religion is that we all live in debt and that we give back and we pay the debt we owe. A man who has a debt and who fails to pay it or refuses to pay it when he is capable of doing so was looked down upon and ostracized by the community. This concept of reciprocal debt and of everyone owing everyone else is what one of the things that tied the economy of the Indian communities together. However, the concept of debt had its extremes as well. When the debt was a life because of a crime committed against another, a murder, an act of passion, then either a geld of sorts had to be determined, a price for the life, the family that had committed the man who had committed the crime then had to pay this to the family of the person who had been killed, or it was a life for a life. Only in this way could a feud be avoided. Warfare on the Northwest Coast really didn't exist among the Salish, though raiding by hostile tribes from the north, Tlinkits, Quaggil, Haida, was pretty common. Though the northern tribes raided into the Puget Sound for slaves, and this kind of fighting was very fierce, very bloody, it was short-lived, but feuds could go on for a long time, and they could involve the lives of many people in the families. It could be a very, very, very terrible thing to live in a feud for a long period of time. And so, generally, everything was done to avoid feuds. But debts had to be paid. Here among the people of this land, there was no kind of army. No one was really a trained warrior. There was not that much physical conflict between people. On the other hand, there was one society among the Salish called the Khanhaneaton. Khanhaneaton. And your guess is as good as mine on spelling. I believe the Kha sound is usually spelled with an X. So Khanhaneaton, which means the Black Fish or Killer Whale Society, which was very common among the Halachaman and among some of the Lushootseed peoples of the Puget Sound. This was a kind of warrior priesthood. It was not made up of young men. It was not like a dog soldier society or anything of that sort in the Plains Indians. In this case, men who had children who were already grown to the point where they were more or less out from underfoot were asked to join the Khanhaneaton, but they could not join without their wives because it meant that being a member of the Khanhaneaton meant that they would live a celibate life and that they would go to wherever they were assigned and they would act as a kind of standing militia. These Khanhaneaton were the closest thing to trained warriors among the Salish, and there might only be one or two of them in a village. They lived like everyone else, fished like everyone else. Their life was no different than anyone else, except that their weapons were always at hand. And in the winter dances they had their own secret rituals, which belonged only to other members of the society. And like I say, they were celibate for the rest of their lives. Both men and women became members. And the women cared for the men and in the society and basically facilitated the operations of the society. It was very much like, in some ways, like the Templars or the Hospitallers. They gave their lives over to a military existence with religious overtones. Sielth was not a Hanhaniton, but in this village there were no Hanhaniton. However, in the village of the man who owed debts which he had refused to pay, there were several Hanhaniton, and they were under the employ of this man. And this man was flaunting his debts to the other village and almost daring or challenging them to come and get him because he had the warriors to fight them off. Sielth came into prominence by devising a plan by which the people could go and capture this man or kill him without any loss of bloodshed except for the man himself. Sielth devised a plan to capture the man when his family were out fishing. And apparently the ambush was so successful that not a person was hurt, except for the great man himself, who, when captured, stood there and refused to bend his neck or to yield or to pay any debts. His head was taken, and by doing this, the feud between the two families was settled. The blood debt was paid. By doing this in a way where there was a minimum amount of bloodshed, Sielth gained prominence within his own community. And other men looked at him as a thinker and as a man who could again organize and see a plan through and use people's talents in an effective way. So in this sadly bloody way, Sielth became Siem. He became a leader. Another story about Sielth's youth comes from the first encounter he had with Governor Isaac I. Stevens. Apparently before the treaty, Stevens had decided that he was going to hand-pick those people he wanted to represent the tribes. He'd gotten together with his Indian agent, I believe the man's name was Simmons, and with another man. They had gone among the white community in Puget Sound and they had said, who are the Indians most likely to be friendly with whites? They went and talked to people such as Dr. Ptolemy of Fort Vancouver, of Fort Nisqually, and basically found those men who were most likely to be friendly and open-minded to the whites. Dr. Ptolemy recommended a young man named Leschi, who had worked at Fort Nisqually, who had shown himself to be a friendly man, and whom Ptolemy respected as an honorable man. Unfortunately, Dr. Ptolemy did not realize that Mr. Stevens, the governor, was not really asking for honorable men. He was asking for agreeable men. And there was a distinction in the governor's mind. When the governor was asked about the Duwamish, Simmons had recommended a young man who was already prominent in the community and who was a natural leader. A man who had shown himself willing to be friendly with the whites, interested in white culture, eager to trade, and a man who had great influence over others, even though he was not really an elder yet. He recommended Siel. Now, needless to say, most white people could not say Siel. That last pronunciation just didn't come across. And all sorts of various pronunciations of his name came out. But somehow Seattle was the one that stuck. Chief Siel met with Governor Stevens prior to the treaty in response to a letter which was sent out by the governor inviting him to the treaty potlatch and a giveaway and appointing him a chief. The letter was very official looking, and in Salish custom it seemed to be an invitation to a potlatch at which the elf would be honored with a new title. This kind of thing went on all the time, and Sealf was very flattered. He thought he was very curious about the white man's chief, wanted to know who this Stevens was, and he wanted to very fervently to be on good relations with Stevens. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. Sealf responded in an Indian fashion. Stevens, on the other hand, responded according to his own vanity, and it was not a good first meeting. Sealf was an overwhelmingly impressive man to meet. He was over 6 foot tall and towered over most other Salish Indians of his own people. So he was physically impressive. He was very wide-shouldered. He was a great canoeman. It's said that he filled a doorway when he walked in. So this huge man, impressive physically, with a great speaking voice, which all Siem had to cultivate, with this shrewd mind and this ability to use people in constructive, cooperative ways, this great man came up to Stevens, who was a short man and of spar, wiry build, who was also crippled in one foot from a wound which he received in the Mexican-American War, and who was so vain about his shortness, feeling that other men would not credit his abilities because of his stature. Stevens was known to be a man who just would not stand next to tall people. Stevens always liked to set things up so that he was on higher ground than everyone else. He apparently had a thing about being taken seriously and about being short. Anyway, Sealf, in his magnanimous nature, upon meeting Governor Stevens, looked down upon him, placed his hand on top of the governor's head, and said a long prayer in his own language, asking God to bless the brotherhood of the two great chiefs. Stevens fumed under the hands of this towering giant, not understanding anything that was going on in the prayer, and from that time on refused to see Sealf in person or to deal with the man except through intermediaries. So what could have been a good beginning was totally misunderstood. And from that time on, Stevens, as I have said, always avoided being in any place where he had to deal directly with Chief Sealf. Those are the two stories that my dear friend Willard Bell gave to me. He also informed me that the Duwamish and the Suquamish people are gradually pulling these things together, and that a biography of Sealf, such as it is being compiled. There is a lot of oral tradition about the man. There are little vignettes and various written sources written by white people about him, but no one yet has pulled together a definitive text about him in his life. That's yet to come. I promise to keep you informed. Feel free to contact Willard Bill and ask him but I will do that for you. And as soon as good materials come through, I promise to forward to you either bibliographical data about Sealth, or when the text from Suquamish is published, let you know about that. Hope you can rewrite these stories in a familiar and funny way, and I hope they'll be of some value to you. God bless.